this weekend, so I had an event. I was here with another colleague of mine, and then I'll be flying back tonight, and then tomorrow I'll be at Lycoming, and I'll be talking a little bit about my story, talking about Straight Ahead, talking about the event that we're doing in Williamsport on Saturday.
Great. Awesome. Well, here we are. The music's winding down. Welcome to Barnstorming PA. I'm really thrilled to do this special episode outside of our Wednesday recording. I'm joined by two guests, and I'll have them introduce themselves in just a sec. If you listen to the show, you know that I'm Jordy Comis, among other roles. I'm a facilitator for the Hub for Progress, which is a network of progressive groups and people across rural PA that is all about shortening the path from passion to action on any kind of issue that fits into the framework of making people's lives better and advancing progressive values. Dave, you want to say hi and then throw it to Tyree, please?
Hey, how y'all doing? My name is David Garlock. I'm the Pennsylvania State Organizer for Straight Ahead, and I'll pass it to Tyree.
Hey, good afternoon. My name is Tyree Little, and I'm an Inside Organizer for Straight Ahead in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
You said Inside?
Yes.
Organizer? Can you say more about what that means?
Inside, well, I reach out to a lot of people that's currently incarcerated, men and women, and then form them, you know, like, for instance, like the forum that we have going on in Lycoming and Williamsport. You know, I reach out to people, you know, from the Lycoming area and surrounding areas, and, you know, ask them to invite their families out, let them know what Straight Ahead is about and what we are fighting for, you know, as far as the life of bills and geriatric prisons, things of that nature, and ask them to have their family support or friends from that county and community to go out and support, you know, what it is that we're doing. I also inform them of, you know, any other policies and bills that's coming up and coming out, just to have a way of communication with those that's still on the inside that's going through the everyday struggle.
Awesome. So just because I'm newer to this, so Inside means like you talk directly to people who are incarcerated and then you help them activate their connections and personal networks. Did I say that right?
Yes.
Awesome. Great. As you all mentioned, November 13th is, an event at Brandon Park in Williamsport, which is the biggest city in Lycoming County, place I know really well. Does one of you all want to say a little bit about, what happens there? And I think it starts at one.
Yeah. It's
I don't have the flyer. Yeah. Go ahead, David.
Yeah. It starts up. So what we're going to do is we're going to have some different people that are formerly incarcerated. We're going to have some of our staff. We're going to have family members. And really, the initial community event is just draw people out to let the community know what we're doing, who we are, and how they can get involved. You know, this month we have some different opportunities for individuals who want to get involved with the work that we're doing. We have a political education program training coming up. We have orientations. There's a lot of different things that we have coming up that are going to help people get involved and allow them to have ways to partner with us. There's a lot of people who always have ideas for as like, how do we get involved? But sometimes they don't have those trainings and things. So we have those trainings coming up later in November, and we're going to connect the men and women that come out on Saturday with these trainings, because it's important for us to get the support of constituents and the family members of those that are incarcerated.
Awesome. So I'm going to take a quick sort of tiny pause here and just remind people that, of course, Wednesday, November 13th at Williamsport in Lycoming County. It's in
Saturday. Park.
Saturday. What did I say? Sunday?
You said Wednesday.
Sorry, Saturday, this Saturday at 1 p.m. in Brandon Park, which is a beautiful green space. Have you been there, Dave?
No, I haven't.
It's just a beautiful space, and I may be totally wrong on this. This is the danger of not doing enough research. I think it was designed by some of the same great park architects who maybe did Central Park, like Olmsted. But it's a huge green space. There was a big Juneteenth there this June that the Williamsport Tri-County, it's the Tri-County NAACP branch I'm a member of. They had a big Juneteenth event there. So it's a great space to be in, in 2020, it was this place where I was very involved in organizing a counter-Nazi event because Derek Slaughter was elected mayor in Williamsport in 2019. He's the first Black mayor of Williamsport. And, you know, we thought it was no accident that this little splinter group of literal Nazis decided to march there to try and get media attention. But anyway, if you're listening to the show, please subscribe to the show. Follow us on YouTube, Twitch, all of the platforms, all the podcast platforms. The talk is free. The show isn't. So if you can support us, please do. We want to thank Jen and Harvey Partika, and also Lisa Johnson Harvey, who are recent patrons to the show who are supporting it. I think that's all the housekeeping I need to get out of the way. Let me throw this back maybe to you, Tyree. My understanding from having talked to Jennifer Black was this thing on Wednesday that you've done others. Have you participated in one of these outreach education events?
Yes, we had some in Philly where, you know, we was doing organizing and things of that nature. So yes, I've been a part of a few of them before. Yes.
What how would you sell it? Like, let's say I'm somebody who hears about it and I don't have anybody in my family who's incarcerated. Like, what would your pitch be? Is that a fair question? Or, you know, Dave, if you want to take it, but like, what would be the reason for me to come?
Cause it's not just about your family, it's about community members. There are a lot of people incarcerated that's from our community that may have done some bad things in the past, but the crimes or things that a person done 20, 30, 40, 50, some even 60 plus years ago, those men and women are not the same individuals today as they were yesterday. Like, you know, people change over time, and this is why we fight so hard for these bills, not only because of what's going on with COVID and we're losing so many men and women in prison with underlying medical conditions, you know, and COVID is taking them out. But there are also so many men and women who have been a positive impact on other prisoners' lives that were formerly incarcerated and came home and have been a major impact in their society. But they're a major impact in their society because of the mentorship and the things they learn from the men and women that don't have a second chance. These men and women were mentoring individuals such as myself that went to prison at an early age. So when you go in at an early age and you come home and you have so many people and you just know that these men and women are not given a second chance, it just make you want to come out here and fight for them. Like, I just want to see everybody come home because I know that they're deserving of it. And again, when we are pushing for these bills and we're asking that, you know, support the geriatric bill, support the lifers bill, that if those bills are granted, it doesn't mean that all these men who were once convicted of murder or whatever the case may have been, that they're automatically just going to be released to the streets. No, we're asking that they're be made to be eligible to see parole. And parole in itself is a whole other process that you had to go through. So just because you're eligible for parole doesn't mean that you're going to make parole and come right home. You have to convince the parole people that you're ready to come home. They have to see change in you. The Department of Correction, the staff members, and everybody that vote, that get your institution support and all that, they have to see a change in you. So the men and women won't just be coming home. But again, it's imperative that we fight these fights because there are just so many great people inside that's deserving of a second chance.
I'm glad you brought it back. The people who are inside. Is there a story from your life that relates to that? I thought you were starting to, you mentioned somebody mentoring you. Is there a story that you could share about what somebody who had been in the inside or is now outside that affected you?
Yes, I could share my story. I'm formerly incarcerated, and it's something that I haven't mentioned early in the show, but I myself at the age of 18 went to prison and was charged with capital murder, aggravated assault, and robbery. And I was facing the death penalty. And after, you know, some court appearances and what have not, the death penalty was eventually taken off the table when I was charged with general charge of murder. So being at that age and charged with such a horrific crime, not really understanding the damage that I've done to not only my family, but the family of the deceased and those of, you know, the people that I robbed or other people that I may have harmed. Like, this is a traumatic affair that is a lifetime. Yes, I was 18. It's a lifetime of a trauma that a person go through that, you know, I just look at it from my point of view, but there's another perspective. Like, the people that I actually done things to that I victimized in my time of adolescence and not knowing any better, not knowing how to value life, not understanding what life is and the value of life. And at that time, when I was doing the things that I was doing, I didn't value my own life because I knew that the things I was doing, I was either going to prison or I was going to go to the graveyard, and I could still continue to do it in my young mind and way of thinking. And it wasn't until after I was arrested and charged and eventually convicted and sent to the state penitentiary, And I came across so many elders, so many older men that like just took time out of their day to try to mentor me. You know, go to school. Do you got it? You got your GED? No, I ain't got no GED. Well, go to school, get your GED. Stop wanting to come to the yard and run around and be a knucklehead all day. Oh, man, I ain't trying to hear that. I got 20 to 40 years. I don't want to hear what you talking about. You've been here all these years. This is the mindset that most young men have entering the prison system. But these men never gave up. They never gave up on us. And it wasn't just me. It was a host of young individuals such as myself. And them men with no incentives involved, like still having a life sentence, nothing involved. They just still take their time to mentor when they can be playing chess, doing legal work, reading books, doing whatever it is, furthering their education, doing whatever it is that they want to do. They took time to mentor individuals as myself. So there are so many of them that started programs in prison, like down SCI Phoenix. You have a program called is the FACT program, Fathers and Children's Together. This is a program that was created by men who's currently incarcerated to where as though there are children on the street who have parents that are incarcerated. They're not allowed to see their parents because they don't have transportation or whatnot. These men have created a program that brings the children to the prison. They can spend time with their loved ones, sit there and draw pictures, read books to one another. These are things that people behind the wall, that people in the outside community deem monsters and unchangeable. No, these men are humans. They have a heart. They are remorseful. They have a solution to the things that's going on in the city of Philadelphia with all the gun violence going on. Like, these are men, the same individuals that are doing things on the street and then go to the prisons. When you look at their prison records, they don't have a bunch of assaults and fights and all this stuff. You know why? Because they are mentored from the very beginning. When they come into that prison system, they are gripped up by some older individuals that say, listen, come on, get it together. And granted, some don't get it together right away, because I was one of the ones that didn't. But overall, when you look at the track record, people get it together. And we come home and we do the things. We come out here, we do the work. And this is how we give back. Not fighting for one individual, but we're fighting for thousands of individuals who's currently incarcerated.
Absolutely, Tari, that is an amazing, you know, story, and you packed a lot in that. Maybe some of those things we'll get back to a little bit later. I wanted to maybe pivot to Dave. I think you said you've done organizing work for a while. Do you mind sharing your story about how you came to this work?
Well, my story is a lot like Tyrese too. I'm formerly incarcerated. When I was 20, I went to prison for a murder charge in Alabama. I was thinking I was going to get the death penalty or life without parole. And probably about 3 weeks after I was arrested, I was just told I was being charged with murder. And so in Alabama, where I was arrested, if you're charged with murder, your potential sentence is 10 years to 99 to life with the possibility of parole. So my brother and I, we had taken the life of the man that who had been sexually and physically abusing us for 8 years. And it was an irrational decision. We wished that we could go back and change it, but we can't, you know. And I served 13 and a half of a 25 year sentence. I got out on parole April 1st, 2013. And I've been out over 8.5 years. Since that time, I graduated college, got married. I have a almost 1 year old child. And I tell people that is what he is, what a second chance looks like. Because if I never received parole, I would have never been able to have a family and to have my son. So the thing there is, I would have ended my sentence October 27th, 2024. But because I was able to make parole, I got out 8.5 years ago. September 14th, I was able to go down to Alabama and I received a pardon. And when I came up to Pennsylvania from Alabama, I went to college and I majored in urban studies, focusing on criminal justice and social welfare. And so my education prepared me for organizing work and getting involved with this type of stuff. And so I went to Eastern University. So I'm actually a client of Brian Stevenson, who wrote the book Just Mercy and is founder of Equal Justice Initiative. And he connected me with Eastern University. And that's how I came up to Pennsylvania. And after I graduated, I've stayed up here and have been involved with multiple aspects of criminal justice reform.
I'm from East Tennessee. Sometimes my accent slips out. You don't sound like you're from Alabama.
I've lived all over the place. I've lived in Florida, South Carolina, Washington, California, Nevada, Louisiana, Alabama, and now Pennsylvania. So it has a combination of an Alabama accent plus a West Coast.
I heard a little bit, you know, and it happens to me too, because now you're saying South Carolina and it's going to pull mine out. But anyway, can you say more about the Equal Justice Initiative? Because, like I said, you know, I'm always hungry to learn things, and that's new information for me.
The Equal Justice Initiative. Brian Stevenson is from up north. He lived in Delaware, and after he graduated from Eastern, he went to Harvard, and he was doing an internship down in Georgia on death row, and he fell in love with this type of work, you know, and so he was able to get a grant to start an organization that worked with people on death row to help provide legal counsel for them. And so they started in 1989 and have been working over 31 years and have helped over, I think it's 150 some people be exonerated. He wrote a book called Just Mercy about some of his cases, you know, and the main case in that book is about Walter McMillian. And he was a gentleman who was charged with murder in Monroeville, Alabama, which is a very racist area. It's where Harper Lee, who wrote To Kill a Mockingbird, is from. And he was sentenced to die, you know, without really any evidence. The evidence they had was another person who was incarcerated who talked about was looking at a murder charge and just made up a statement to get out of his sentence, you know. And so he's Equal Justice Initiative and Brian Stevenson have done a lot of work around people on death row, and they've also done a lot of work recently around lynchings. So they've come up with and have found that out that there were about 4,000 lynchings in the U.S. and they've gotten soil and markers for all of them. So if people are in Montgomery, Alabama, I would definitely recommend to go to the different museums that Equal Justice has created.
I think I've seen photographs of that museum in Alabama and some of the memorials, and we've mentioned it in the past on the podcast. I don't know what people are doing across Pennsylvania, but you know, if anybody has this idea that Pennsylvania was somehow immune from the, you know, the ugly and very real real American history of racism and lynching, that they should check it out because it happened here too.
All they would have to do is go to Coatesville, Pennsylvania. In 1912, there was a lynching. A guy named Zechariah Walker was lynched in Coatesville, Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I kind of put air quotes, of course, it's an audio podcast, but in this current weird, silly, to me, silly debate about, you know, whether critical race theory is a hysteria, but it's like, if you're teaching real American history, you're going to be talking about how completely entwined race and racism are in American history. There's no American history that exists aside from it up to the present moment. But anyway, my editorializing aside, I just wanted to revisit a little bit on Saturday. So, David, you're going to be there. Like, is there kind of a set program for what happens, or is it more kind of open-ended? What would people expect?
I mean, we definitely have an agenda as far as the different speakers and how it's going to flow. But there is going to be time afterwards, you know, where we're going to give an open mic for family members to speak, to share about their loved ones, you know, because that's one thing that we love, you know, because we're not doing this just to do this. We're doing it for these men and women and their loved ones, you know. That's why Tyree has such an integral role in the work that we're doing, because he's reaching out to the family, to the men and women that are in the inside, because that's how we're gaining a lot of momentum, by them reaching out to their family members. Because some of the biggest advocates in Pennsylvania around criminal justice reform are the men and women that are incarcerated. And people were always like, wait, what? How in the world is that possible? Because these men and women know that they have life without parole sentence. They're going to die if they don't fight. And they're like, I'm fighting for my life, and it's important to them, and it's important to the next man that they're doing the time with, and that's why they fight so hard.
Tori, you wanted to get in on this?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Y'all can hear me?
Yeah.
Oh yes. Like, you know, when we sit back and think about it, like, now I think about it, I serve out of 20 to 40 years, since I served 20 years and 7 months, so I always just say 21 years. And I've been home now in approximately about 16 months. And again, you know, my work every day, I wake up with the passion to do this work. And this is just one of my jobs. This is just one of my jobs. Like, I also work with Philadelphia Anti-Violence, Anti-Drug Network here in Philadelphia, where we go to communities and talk to people who've been, you know, victims of gunshot or any type of victims through violence in Philadelphia. You know, we goes out and we talk to these people, and we just, you know, slide on corners and just talk to regular individuals, young men, try to offer them opportunities. If they need help with housing, we can try to provide resources or, you know, just things of that nature, and just talk to them about the importance of just living life. Like, just have fun. Like, there's just so much anger and bitterness in the world, but it come from so much trauma as kids. And a lot of us deal with trauma, don't even know where it come from. But as y'all was just speaking, a lot of it comes from historical facts that we're dealing with trauma from over 400 years ago. And a lot of people still don't understand it. And then, you know, now you live up to now and you see the things that's going on in the world. And, you know, I honestly didn't really believe that racism existed the way it did until I was sentenced to state prison. When I was in the prisons in them rural areas, I've really seen it. I had COs that told me the first time they ever, you know, talked to a black man is when they started working at the prison. They never had encountered nobody outside of their race. So there is you know, everything is just is a race thing in America, and is a problem that we have, and it's just affecting all parts yeah, of America. And
for sure,
we got to find a solution to do better, because is affecting our generations. They're building prisons and closing down schools. When I came home, I go through my neighborhood, I see about 5 or 6 abandoned schools that the property's just sitting there. They're just sitting there not doing nothing. So you're putting money into prisons and taking away the education from children. So it's like you're breeding our children to say, or to know, you're going to end up in prison. Forget your education, you're just going to prison anyway.
Right.
So there's no hope. I mean, you don't have the recreation centers or anything. So it's just bad.
Mm-hmm. No, I hear you. I, you know, I like to try and, you know, I'm not a journalist. I don't pretend to be like objective. That's not what we do on this podcast. But, you know, I grew up in a very economically privileged kind of place in East Tennessee. I went to a private school because my parents, I had a learning disability and I'm ADHD, and my parents didn't think the public schools, you know, would be a good fit. So a lot of my life has been about understanding that and, like, you know, what can I do to share the blessings that I have? And so things like prison reform would have been, like, intellectually an issue. You know, you show me the cost per person for education versus prison. Like, I get that. But something the last couple of years sort of path my life has taken, and a lot of it, the uprising, to be honest, last summer, you know, it's just opened my eyes to things. And so, like, for example, I've had conversations with friends from the same high school, and people should know that East Tennessee, unlike parts of the South, is historically less racially diverse, right? Like, Knoxville, I grew up, is about 90% white, but my high school there was nobody in my high school of 100 students. There was no black students in my class, right? Like, in my school, yes, but not in my grade. And the first black teacher I had was in college. And, that's a tiny thing compared to like violent overt racism that a lot of people of color face, but it's not neutral, right? Like, that affected me too. You know, it made me walk on eggshells around black people. And, like, I try and do some anti-racism stuff in my church and other places. And I usually say, like, the best thing, like, I grew up being told that to talk about race is racist, right? Like, don't talk about race. And I had to learn, like, most white people need to talk about race to learn how to talk about race. And it's going to be ugly sometimes, and they're going to say some awkward things. But usually, and even if I do, and if I did now, please let me know, there's a lot of grace. There's a lot of grace out there from people. And if your intentions are good, you know, people understand. So I don't know if that made sense, but I was just kind of trying to come back to what you were saying about people being exposed to racism for the first time, you know, inside the system. I've met black folks out here in rural PA, you know, told me, I moved to a little town in Pennsylvania from Philly or from Baltimore. I was 8 or 9. I've heard this story like 5 times in the last year. It's the first time I encountered racism like that, right? When I moved to a little town in Pennsylvania. And I love these little towns, but I'm also like, that is some ugly shit that we got to clean up. So anyway, I don't know if you guys want to take it up.
I mean,
end on a good point.
I mean, in really, when you get outside of Pittsburgh, when you get outside of Philly, I mean, you get, like, central PA, you know, is a lot of racism. You know, I was told, when I met my wife, she's from outside of York. you know, and my father-in-law, he's like, hey, you know, you have Pittsburgh, you have Philly, and everything in between is Alabama. And really, when I went out to their house the first time and I saw all these Confederate flags and everything, I was like taken back. I'm like, wait, am I actually in Alabama again? Because it just really blew my mind. But then we look at the race, you know, there's 13% African Americans in Pennsylvania. Do you know what percentage there is of African Americans in prison?
I'm a bit of a what do you call it in pool? Somebody who's playing dumb, and then they take your money. What's that called in pool? A hustler? No,
you're a hustler. Anyway, yeah,
it's probably 37%.
52.
Oh, I'm not even good at it. That's unbelievable.
Yeah, you're not good at it. So don't quit doing the podcast. You know, keep doing the podcast. You know, we'll be good. But.
This is a wealth creating activity, not a wealth creating activity.
But that's the thing, you know, you have so many people are like, oh yeah, there's not racism. There's not systematic. It's like, if you don't believe in systematic racism, all you have to do is look at the criminal justice system across the country. It's the same thing. There's smaller percentages of African Americans in every state, and there's 40 to 60%, if not more, of African Americans in prison. You know, so you cannot tell me it's not a racial thing. It all goes back to theories like broken windows, you know, that tells you if there's a place that has a lot of broken windows, graffiti, the cops are going to send more police there and arrest people. And the same crime is happening in the white neighborhoods. It's just nicer there. And a lot of times the police are from there, so they're not going to, like, surveil their own areas, you know.
So I didn't say I'm a local elected. I'm on my borough council, and part of that is I am also my local police commission. And I wish I could say that I had a lot of time to deeply invest in like researching all of this, but the sad truth is, like, mostly when you're a local elected of a small place, you're just running from meeting to meeting. But as these issues have come up, you know, it's been an issue for me, and we have brought up, like, hey, like, I don't want our police to be a revenue source. Like, I read the DOJ report from Ferguson outside of St. Louis, and I'm like, because one piece is bias, right? Another piece is if you build structures that create incentives for people to enact those biases. So, like, I don't know if you know this, but in Ferguson, all of these things get tied together. You know, the local officials didn't want to raise taxes. The tax base was shrinking. And so they turned to the police and they're like, hey, you know what? Like, you got to be a profit center. Like, if you're in government, you hear somebody say profit center. I used to be a business professor. That's scary, because, like, government should be providing services efficiently and effectively, not trying to maximize profit. So I see a lot of head nodding. Do you guys want to jump in on that one? Because I just realized I walked into private prisons as like a whole nother
topic. Well, I mean, it's really not private prisons per se, because when you think about that, you know, you have so many people that's the first thing they say. It's not really private prisons. Private prisons only house about 8% of the folks that are incarcerated.
In Pennsylvania?
So, no, nationwide.
Nationwide. Okay, that's good to know. I didn't know that. Keep going.
Yeah. And in Pennsylvania, there's only one privately run prison, and that's Delaware County, G.W. Hill, I think. That's the only one, and it's run by Geo Group. So your two biggest private prison organizations are Geo Group and Core Civic. But really, where the money is coming in, as far as labor for or just organizations that are getting prison labor, you know, that is one thing. They're paying 18 cents to a dollar an hour. Where if they were getting that labor out on the streets, they'd have to pay at least $7.50 to $15 or more. You know, that's one thing. But the other aspect are the phone calls or medical is commissary. I mean, there's some prisons in Pennsylvania that Aramark does their food in the dining commons and then also does the commissary. So they're double dipping here. They know if we give worse food in the dining commons, they're going to have to buy all this junk food off the commissary. So they're making bank.
I assume that their contract is X amount per meal per person that they get paid. They have every incentive in the world to minimize the inputs in terms of food and labor. And, you know, I imagine who's going to complain, right? Like if they do that at a college, the students and the parents will push them to invest more. But am I right? Like in a prison situation, there's no downside for them to maximize that gap. Am I making sense?
Yeah, absolutely. In Alabama, there some of the food that would come in said not fit for human consumption.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so the commissary for people who don't understand, as I understand, that's a place where people who are incarcerated can use funds that they get from the pittance that they're paid and or whatever people, you know, family or friends give to them. Right. Are they protected from price gouging? Like if they want.
A pack of ramen noodles. Well, I just seen it.
Price gouging.
This is the first time I got you guys laughing. I don't know what that says. Keep going.
The food. And see, there's a difference between a state and a county prison. It's like in Philadelphia, in a county prison, a pack of ramen noodles is like $1.50. When you get upstate, that same pack of ramen noodles is about 40 cents now. When I first went up in 2001, a pack of ramen noodles was 12 cents. And from 2001 over the years, they went up. It increased from 12 cent to about 40 cent now.
So in the commissary.
In the commissary, right.
I think Alabama is like 80 cents now for ramen noodles. So, yeah, it's
$1.50.
And that's the thing, you know. I mean, and just to think about it this too, you know, think about you're making 18 cents an hour. You don't have family sending you money. If you go see the doctor, it's $5 a visit to the doctor, $5 for every prescription. Say you're sick, they give you two prescriptions. That's $15 for just one visit, and you might make $25 a month. Yep. How much money do you have left for that month?
And then if you owe courts and fines, you don't even get the whole 25. You might only going to see 20 out of that.
Then you only have $5. Now, with $5, do you buy soap and toothpaste? Or do you buy something to eat or some coffee?
Are the is the labor that's done in prison also competing in the outside market? You know, are they producing goods that have to compete with people who have to pay actual minimum wage? Do you know what I mean?
In prison, you work, you might make you start off at 19 cents an hour. And in some prisons, like in other states, you don't get paid to work. You just forced to work. But I mean, they start you off at like 19 cents an hour. Then you can work your way up to about 42 cents an hour.
I feel like I've seen news or documentaries where in some places, maybe not in Pennsylvania, a prison might take a contract to like stuff boxes, for example. Well, that's right. A contract that a private company in the outside world would be paying at least minimum wage. But now they have to compete against prison wage labor.
Absolutely. You know, I don't think that's as prevalent in Pennsylvania, but yeah, all over the country. And at times with some of your federal prisons, they have those contracts too. And so that's why, you know, it's kind of thinking about like the TV show Orange is the New Black.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people would look at that as like Orange is the New Black. Oh, Orange is this new fad. You know, I always looked at it a different way. You know, I looked at it as in a way where they're saying prison is the next form of slavery. And that's one thing Brian Stevenson always talks about. He says slavery never went away. It just continued to evolve. And now it's evolved into mass incarceration. You know, it went from slavery to Jim Crow to mass incarceration.
I want to kind of pivot a little bit because I don't want to lose sight. Like the Straight Ahead, as I understand it, is a newer effort that is a couple of organizations or primarily. Can you explain either one of you where Straight Ahead fits into this? And then also, like, I think they have a specific policy agenda, which we've hit on a lot of, but maybe we should lay it out for everybody. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so Straight Ahead, we are an organization. We are a C4. So we started in January. So we got a grant from Open Society to work to create two bills, one for the lifer bill, one for geriatric medical parole. So we are a sister organization for the Abolitionist Law Center, which was founded in 2013. They are the C3.
Pretty new, really, ALC.
Yeah, so we were created because they were doing some of this work in lobbying, but as a C3, you're limited on how many hours you can do for lobbying. Whereas C4, we can do unlimited lobbying hours, you know? And so that's what we do, you know? I mean, since our creation, we've probably had 80 different, we've had 80 different meetings with senators and representatives. And so, I mean, that's something that's been amazing, you know, just to think in 9-10 months, we've met with 80 legislators and we've reached out to like 150.
I think there are, and I should know this, 200 and some legislators in Pennsylvania.
I think there's like 212 represent like 42 senators or some, or 52, 26, 52, something like that.
51. Okay. 262. Yeah. That is impressive. And, so can we drill down a little bit, Tyree? I don't know if you want to jump in. So there's two bills. You said geriatric. Can you say this again for me?
Geriatric. We have the geriatric bill, which focusing on the elderly 55 and over that's have any underlying medical conditions that's, you know, can, you know, pretty much take them out through COVID. And we have the lifers bill where we're trying to gain parole eligibility for people serving life without the possibility of parole, because in Pennsylvania, if you convicted of first or second degree murder, it was an automatic life sentence in Pennsylvania. So you're serving life without the possibility of parole. And these are the bills that we're fighting to try to change to gain parole eligibility for the men and women that's still currently incarcerated serving life sentences.
Does Pennsylvania, I feel like I've seen this, have extraordinarily high and therefore deeply depressing number of older prisoners? Is that right?
Yes.
There's over about 10,000 people that are 55 and older out of 39,000 people that we have incarcerated. But it's not just Pennsylvania. The prison population of 55 and older in the country is 30% of the prison population. So, and something to think of is, as one of my colleagues, Megan Novisk at Cleveland State University, always says, she's like, there is not this massive crime wave of people with walkers and wheelchairs committing crimes. Mm-hmm. It's because of our lengthy sentences. It's because there's 5,447 people serving life without parole in Pennsylvania. That's 10% of the country's life without parole population. So 1 out of 10 people serving life without parole are in Pennsylvania.
That is really, really high. I mean, we've only got about, sometimes I know this number, 12 or 18 million, but we're, you know, obviously, we're nowhere near 10% of the population of the United States, so we're way out of proportion there. Are there reasons that these things are, you know, structurally so much worse here that matter for what you're doing? I mean, is it something about our legislature? Is it something about, I don't know, Pennsylvania politics? Like, I'm just throwing this out there.
All the above.
Yeah.
A lot of it is because we have these archaic laws in effect. So 1941.
These aren't like war on drugs laws. These are more recent. I mean, these are older, you're saying, some of them. Maybe.
Yeah, 1941, we started giving out life without parole sentences. We're the third state behind Vermont and Maine. Vermont and Maine hardly ever use it. You know, we are still one of the top states that are giving this out. Now, if you look at one state that has more people serving life without parole than Pennsylvania, that's Florida. The only reason they have more is the population is bigger. As far as like per capita, we are giving out the most life without parole sentences. And it's mandatory for first and second degree murder. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. It's a mandatory sentence.
I'm still on the Zoom and I'm going to call you back when I'm done about 15 minutes.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. Because Vermont, Maine, and Pennsylvania, 1941, if I'm trying to, like, in my head, and I maybe shouldn't do this, but if I'm speculating, that could have been a, like, we don't want to have the death sentence, right? Like, those were states that maybe historically had, more of a concern about that. You know, I'm thinking about how Catholic Pennsylvania is. Like, Pennsylvania is more Catholic than some places, and I think that that affects the politics sometimes at the level of like political values. But you know what I'm saying? Like, you can imagine that law was passed then, right? And then a lot of states until the 70s were moving away from the death penalty, but it was there. And then once you add on all of the war on drug kinds of policies, it seems like I'm being a little bit speculative, but maybe those things kind of interacted in a way.
It probably did, but another thing we have to look at too is up until 1978, Pennsylvania was using commutations as a parole by proxy. So the average time that somebody would be incarcerated for a life without parole sentence was anywhere from 17 to 21 years. And from 1971 to 1978, there were 250 people that were stations. In the last 15 years, I think there were 32. So we have gone from using commutations as a parole by proxy to not letting anybody out and exacerbating our system by continuously sentencing people to these life without parole sentences. And now they don't have any ways to get out. And all you have to do is just look at the past couple of years and just how many people are applying for commutation and how many people are getting turned down. Even with support, like a lot of support, they're still getting turned down because it goes back to a political thing. And there is conversation, there is talk from different representatives and senators about abolishing life without parole. Now, what that is moving forward. That's not making it retroactive. So that's why we still have to do this work that we're doing as Straight Ahead for all those people that have already been sentenced to life without parole. Yes, we want these laws to pass where life without parole is no longer an option, but we can't just say, okay, that's good, and allow the men and women who are currently serving these sentences to be left behind.
So just to fill this in, so it sounds like what you're saying is there was a period of time when at least there was the practice that commutation could be used to take people out of the system if it didn't seem like there was no good reason anymore. And I mean, this totally makes sense to me from what I understand is like you start with the 70s, and this goes back to race. I think there's a lot of good analysis about this. You know, as we move more into a more racially integrated society, crime rates are going up in cities. Most of, let's say, white America turned to this. You know, cities are dangerous, drugs are dangerous, black people are dangerous. And we basically kind of sort of re-apartheided, if I can make that a verb, re-segregated a lot of parts of our society, but around, you know, using the judicial system and the criminal justice system, so that like the whatever constituency there was to use commutation in the 50s and 60s and 70s in Pennsylvania step back, and whether or not they're aware of it, it could have become racialized because it was like, we're not going to commute those people. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. And it all goes back to a point that Tyree had already made, you know, that just because somebody goes to prison at a young age, after they've served decades in prison, they're not the same person. When you look at the average age for somebody going to prison on a life without parole sentence, 73% of them are under 25, 50% of them are under 21. And I mean, what we have to realize, and there's such a high number of people that are black and brown skin, you know, so it goes back to these are young individuals who are making irrational decisions and choices, but they have been rehabilitated. They have changed their lives around. They're not only just in prison, now they're mentoring folks. They're living vicariously through other men and women as they get out of prison. You know, there's people in Tyree's life who are living through what Tyree's doing, you know, and hoping and praying that they get the opportunity to come out here and have the same type of impact that Tyree's having in Philadelphia.
Tyree, I just wanted to bring you back into this too. I had a question. What was it? Oh yeah. So if we're talking about this campaign, like what, is there something that you wish people understood, or is there sort of a common misconception you run into when you're trying to convince people that these are bills we're supporting? Does that make sense as a question?
Yes. That everybody who committed a crime is not a bad person. Like there was circumstances that now granted, you know, for anybody to lose a life is devastating on both ends. As far as a person who lost his life, you know, that family that family has to go through losing a child, father, husband, brother, etc. And on the same token as the person who took the life, you know, your family is going through turmoil. You're going through turmoil. You've been in prison. But the biggest thing is, like, that I would just ask people to know is that people change. Like, ask yourself, are you the same person you were 5 years ago? Like, and these are things that we have to do and just think about humanity. People think that, oh, a person go to prison and are they living this luxurious life? No, like, prison is the most humiliating, degrading place, scum of the earth. It's like, it's nothing positive there except the men and women that are trying to do positive things, that are really trying to change their mind and their way of thinking. They come out here and be better members of society. Like, it's so bad in prison that in 2017, I believe it was February, there was an altercation at one of the state prisons in Pennsylvania, and where a man was accused of attacking a police, a correctional officer, and they got into a fight, and the correctional officer was on the ground gradually, and the individual, the prisoner, allegedly kicked him in his head. And he was wearing a pair of Timberland boots that was purchased off commissary. Now, because of this act, unfortunately, the correctional officer passed away. So they made a ban in Pennsylvania on Timberland boots. You're not allowed to have Timberland boots. People had just purchased boots a week before this incident, and they made you send them home without giving you any refund of your money or anything. That's extortion. It's just, things are just not right. It's just not right. It's extortion. And these are just some of the small tokens. Like, now you got weather that's 10 degrees, and you got men walking around with sneakers on. Mm-hmm. And it's snow and ice. Can't even have boots. You want to go out there and work and shovel snow and sneakers. Won't even proud of boots. Yet and still, let's count how many correction officers have jumped on prisoners. Prisoners lost their lives, but no clothing change has been admitted on a correction officer. Let's talk about how we're in prison right now. The men and women are almost forced to take a COVID vaccination. If you're not, you're isolated and housed on a unit with just the individuals who chose not to, for whatever reason, take the vaccination. So those individuals are only coming out for about a half hour a day, limited phone calls and showers. They're not allowed to have contact visits with their loved ones, as if like the other people who took the vaccination. Now, my biggest problem with this is your staff haven't even been vaccinated. They come to work every single day, not vaccinated, and around the same men and women that y'all won't let nobody else around. How is this fair? How is this humane?
So the same staff who are with the unvaccinated incarcerated people could then go over and be exposing the vaccine.
You're going home every day. You're in public every day. No telling the safety precautions that you're taking. Even in prison, they don't walk around when the epidemic first started. They wasn't walking around properly wearing a mask. They wasn't changing their gloves out like they supposed to. And men were dying. We had no contact visits with nobody from the outside. Yet and still, COVID made it into those prisons and killed over 100 people. How?
Through the same way the drugs were coming in?
Right.
Same way. Y'all stopped the mail. Our mail have to go to Florida and all these things because y'all say the drugs was coming in through the mail. Y'all have higher drug rates and busts now in prison where there were no visits than y'all did when there were visits. But nobody talking about that. Nobody want to talk about that.
So it sounds like what unites a lot of those is a lot of hypocrisy at the level of the people making the decisions about what happens in prison. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but okay. Dave, is there something for you, David, like sort of a common misconception in this work that you want to address?
Yeah, I'd say one of the main things is that we do this work for the men that and women that are incarcerated. This does not mean that we do not care about the victims. We do not care about the family members of those who have lost people. We understand that, you know, we know that lives have been lost, but we just don't feel like taking another person's life is the same thing. That's not justice, you know? And what is called about. You know, we don't just call this life without parole. People that are on the inside, they call it death by incarceration. This is another death penalty. It's just a longer death penalty because it's going to take 30, 40, 50, 60 years of you just withering away in prison to die. You know, the last 3 years I served, I did hospice work in Alabama. And so I saw men just withering away and dying, you know, and I saw some men that I served time with years earlier, big and strong, and here they're coming in like 150 pounds, shrunk up, just face drawn all the way in, you know, when you're like, what happened? And cancer riddled their, you know, and these men should have been released and spent their last days, weeks, and at home, but they weren't. They were forced to die in prison, you know, and that shouldn't be happening. Our prisons should not be hospitals. Our prisons should not be hospice care centers where these men are dying and at times just put in a cell and left there for a couple hours at a time, and then a nurse will come by to check on them. It should not be the case.
No, that's really powerful. And I think both of you mentioned in different, David, you mentioned the, and I blanked on the exact name, but the program that you were involved in, with Brian Stevenson.
Full Justice Initiative.
Equal Justice. But Tyree, you also said, I think you said something about working, I know there's some transformative justice too, but I thought you mentioned something in your story about being involved in that piece of it. Am I right?
Yes, I also work with, I'm speaking about my jobs that I have, and I was also saying that I work with the PAN, the Philadelphia Violence Anti-Drug Network. You know, when we go through the communities and speak to people, you know, that was in, mm-hmm. involved with gun violence or things of that nature, or any type of violence was harmed or whatever. And, you know, or just young guys that need any type of advice or, you know, trying to get some assistance with housing and anything, we can, you know, refer them to resources, you know, give them some referrals and stuff, and try right. to help out any way that we could to pretty much get a lot of these young guys off the street, because a lot of them just need opportunity. They just need somebody to talk to. Like right now, we're going through a lot of mental health trauma, and a lot of them don't even understand it or recognize the trauma that they're going through. And this is why they're acting out and doing the things they're doing. So we just have to take the time out and just listen, talk. Like talk to the young men and women. Don't talk down to them. Don't talk at them. Talk to them. Listen to mm-hmm. them. Understand them. Understand mm-hmm. that you were once their age and the things that you've been through, so you thought like they thought. So take yourself back to that time period and think like them and understand what's going on in their mind, and then try to come up with a solution to solve the problems that's going on.
That's awesome. So I want to thank you both for spending so much time with me today and educating people in our audience. I'll put links to the event and also Straight Ahead. If you have any, you know, whether Twitter or, you know, if you yourselves have your own or David, you said, you know, if you have your own website for speaking, let me know. And I'm happy to put that in, Tyree, or if you have any, you know, anything, you know, way for people to find you online or whatever. I'm happy to do that. I just want to leave with this and let you all have the last word. It seems to me that this can really be a bipartisan issue. So I don't know if either one of you want to talk about the potential for this to bring people together from either party or from different ideological perspectives.
Well, I mean, in the House, we've definitely been talking to a Republican who is very on board with supporting the geriatric medical parole bill. And so he's definitely going to be somebody that's going to be championing this, you know. And the reason that he had a lot of change is he went to SCI Muncie, you know. So before he went to a prison, he never would have thought about being involved with criminal justice reform and wanting to do anything about those who were incarcerated. But then he was there. He walked into the prison. He saw these women and the conditions they were in. And I think a lot of it, you know, he is a man of faith, you know. So it goes to Hebrews 13:3 that says, you have to remember those in prison as you were there in prison with them. And so that was definitely powerful for him.
Tyree, you want to add anything?
Yes, I was just looking at some of the things, and I think that the opioid epidemic a lot has played a lot, because once that started hitting the rural areas, now there's a big problem. Now there's an opioid crisis. When it was just in Kensington and Allegheny and the so-called hood communities, it wasn't an opioid crisis. But now when, the rich doctors and lawyers and their children are starting to die from, these overdose pills and these fentanyl-laced pills, now there's a crisis. It's been a crisis. Y'all want to pit centers where people can just voluntarily go shoot up drugs and do all that stuff. Like, build more rehab centers, build more schools, build things of substance, and stop focusing so much attention on prisons unless your attention is shifted and geared towards bringing the many men and women home that deserve of a second chance. Because again, as I said earlier, people are not the same. People change over time. Some change for the better, some change for the worse. Some really don't change at all. However, there are so many people that have changed that I've witnessed, and these men are not given that second chance. And then to make matters worse, a lot of them haven't even taken a life. They was an accomplice. They may have been asleep in a car and somebody did something. And they may have been 18 and the accomplice was 17. The accomplice is now home and then they're still suffering in prison. And they never even took a life. And we talk about justice. We talk about humanity. This is insane. It's inhumane. And it's an injustice. And it's you have a hard time trying to maintain your sanity in insane places. So I ask that people just open up your eyes and pay attention to what's really going on. Don't listen to the lies that's being told on the tell lie vision, because that's what it is. Don't listen to the lies on it.
That's
Waterloo, Lackawanna, Fairview, Bellevue, Sweet Roots, Susquehanna, Lewisburg, Stroudsburg, Gillesburg, Orbisonia, Harrisburg, Pittsburgh, Wellesburg, Robsonia, Mountaintop, Glen Rock, Flat Rock, Sunbury, St. Mary, Schick, Shanny, Big Shanny, I'm a dandy. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. I cross the valley, spare man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man.